Hey everyone, Matt Koss here with a cold open because I wanted to let everyone know, even though you'll hear it in the interview with sommelier Christian Hamel, who is the wine director at Harbor 60. Also, he's a wine importer. He's got a wine company called Pelican Wine Imports. But we are entering wine sommelier competition. That's right. BOSC, which is the Best Ontario Sommelier Competition, is going on January 28th at Bovine Wine Club, which if you listen to the pod, you heard me talk about it in the last one. It's at Union Station. I just wanted to sort of highlight it because our next two guests, Christian Hamel and then the other one, Matthew Landry. These are two sommeliers. Both of them will be competing for the title of Best Ontario Sommelier. I am a huge fan of wine events. In fact, I remember one time we're having a little party, small one, just like eight, nine people over at my place, and I decide to put on in the background, I just on YouTube, on the TV. You can do that. You can put YouTube on the TV. It's crazy, kids these days. I put on like a random wine competition, and within 30 seconds, my girlfriend is just staring daggers at me, wondering, what the hell are you doing? And for a second, I actually did the dumb thing that we'll do, where we just go, what? What? What did I do? I realize I never should have done that. You don't put that on, but I am addicted to these sorts of competitions just because I know how hard it is. I know the work that goes into it. Obviously, I'm part of the demo for these events where you get to see these sommeliers tested in these high-pressure situations where they'll be thrown random questions and tastings and all these things. And maybe because I also work in sports, I find them so compelling because these are the best of the best, doing what they do best in competition against one another. It's like watching a playoff game. So I'm a huge fan. That's why I was thrilled in conjunction with CAPS, the Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers, with the people there involved, to help set it up, where I got to interview some of the competitors. So there's going to be two of them coming out, and we don't just talk about the competition. We talk, all things wine, their journeys. For this one with Christian Hamel, wine pairings, great wine pairings you can do that will not kill your budget, especially if you go to a place like Harbor 60, which it's not inexpensive. Anyway, I've rambled enough. So again, Bovine Wine Club, January 28th is where you want to go. If you want to go to tickets, it's a long website. I throw in the link on the Instagram, but if you just type in Best Ontario Somm Competition, or if you go to CAPS, the Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers, you'll find it. In fact, you're smarter than me. You can Google this in 9 seconds. Anyway, without further ado, here is Christian Hamel.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm here at the Vintage Conservatory on King West. This place is gorgeous, but really any of these sort of wine clubs are always gorgeous. And the great thing about this place, you can't find it. It's so hard to find. I'm shocked I was able to because I got the worst sense of direction. And joining me is Christian Hamel, who is the wine director now for Harbor 60, a sommelier, co-founder of Pelican Wines Import, and will be competing very soon for the Best Ontario Somm Competition. Christian, thank you so much for being part of the pod.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start in something very different. You opened up a really old, beautiful bottle of wine that I appreciate. It's from an area that I love. It's a style of wine that I love. I was wondering if you could tell people what we're sipping on.
Absolutely. Well, I'm a big fan of all things wine, of course, but the Loire Valley always had a special place in my heart. I think the wines are always incredible, very, very flavorful, easy pairing, or very fun for food, but also they offer great value. I think you can buy top of the line Loire Valley for mid-range Burgundy, even price-wise. So what we just opened, had a handful of those bottles. It's Domaine de la Rochelle-Moine, Chenin Blanc from the Appellation Sommelier Rochelle-Moine. This one is a Cuvée des Nonnes, so they made only five vintages of this. It's a late harvest Chenin Blanc, so only on the best hot years. They'll hold back the grapes on the vines and they gather them later. Leaves a bit of residual sugar. We're drinking today the 2002, so 22 years of aging in the bottle, really integrated the sugar, and I just think it's phenomenal, great. Then you lose that kind of dessert wine feel and just becomes a great fruity wine.
Yeah, there's nothing dessert about this. This is very much more just rich, full-bodied, full of life. This is a beautiful one. So first, thank you for that.
Of course.
You know what? Let's start with Sauvignon for a quick second. I am a big fan of that region, of that style of wine. For people that don't mind spending, because it's not cheap. I mean, you can get good stuff that's not nowhere near going to break the bank. But for someone looking to try something different, a white wine of a real serious note, what do they need to know?
Yeah, Sauvignon. What I love is not just the terroir. You have beautiful schist, which I think gives some of the best example of Chambord from the Loire Valley. But the mix of that morning fog, the warm afternoons, the concentration you get from the grapes will grade, will give you phenomenal Chenin blanc to drink. But mainly, I think it's the ethos of all the winemakers in the region, especially Sauvignon and Sauvignon Rochemaune. You look at producers like Nicolas Joly and Domaine de la Rochemaune, definitely more on the low intervention, but they don't make divisive styles of wine, right? The wine is very clean, but they're still low intervention, using sulfites. It's basically they don't use the chemicals you don't need to be. And I think that's where what people are looking for these days. They're not looking for the most extreme example, natural wine, but we also want to get away from the industrial style of winemaking. So these are wines great.
It's beautiful. Again, appreciate it. One of the reasons I want to have you on is I love wine competitions, maybe partially my sports media background. I will watch YouTube clips of wine competitions from a decade ago. My girlfriend will look at me just wondering, what the hell are you doing? And you're going to be competing soon in the Canadian, or the CAPS, Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers, for people who don't know, for the best Ontario sommelier competition. How do you prep for this upcoming event?
Well, that's the thing, it's hard to prep because you kind of know, but you don't know what's coming your way, right? It's gonna be my second time trying for what we call BOSC or Best Ontario, Best Ontario Sommelier Competition. So you gotta prep thinking, okay, well, they can throw everything at you, right? It can be tasting, blind tasting, sorry, it can be service of wines, non-wines, sparkling wine, red wines, like it doesn't matter what it can be, table side. You gotta recognize vineyards by the way they look. They can just show you a bunch of like estates and tell us like, okay, where is this? It can be Vic in Chile, it can be Errázuriz, it can be Marques and Murrieta, and then you're just gonna be able to identify them. Like, so yeah, it's testing your culture very wide. And that's why I like it, because all the competitors that goes there will have our expertise. And it's really usually balanced in a way that if it was just service, well, the service beast will usually win. But there's gonna be theory, there's gonna be tasting. So we all have our strengths and weaknesses, and that's gonna be a good challenge for everybody.
What's your strength and what's your weakness?
That's a good question. I like to think that my strength is showmanship and tableside service. I got to work on my tasting this year for sure. I've taken a bit of a break for tasting recently, so I need to get back into this. But tableside salesmanship is definitely what I like to do the most. And that's usually what I do on the floor most as well.
How do you, because when someone is working to get better at, say, they want to be a better football player, well, you can lift weights, get stronger, run faster, watch game plans, devise all that kind of stuff. How do you get better as a taster? How do you get better at blind taste?
So, truth of the matter is, competition is a points game, much like many other sports. I can't have a wine in front of me talk to you about for half an hour, call it 100% right, and maybe not do as well as the next guy. There's a grid by what we call the ASI, or the Association des Sommeliers International, and these guys will tell you, all right, for when it comes to visual, we're looking for viscosity, color, intensity, variation, and so on. And you're going to make sure that you describe all of these things in your speech. So you're going to make sure that you count all the points. So it's, I don't want to call it playing the game, but you're going to know what they're looking for, right? It's
Right.
to make it an even playing field, they're going to have a grid to grade everybody the same way. So you're going to be aware of what that grid is. And it is public knowledge on the International Sommelier website. We use the same standard as the Best Sommelier of the World competition when it comes to this. So you're going to learn that grid and then practice integrating those points into a relatable and understandable speech. Because you cannot just call it's yellow, it's viscous. You got to make it interesting.
All right, then how about you don't have to do it every step and go full grid. This is not part of the competition. So this is a more casual tasting. How would you, if in the competition, the wine that you just poured, how would you describe it to the judge? How would you do
Well,
it?
First thing I would do is put my nose in it and then thank the panel for pouring me a wine like this because I love that stuff. First thing you do, you put your nose in, like, I'm going to have fun. So even if I don't get it right, at least I taste something delicious. First thing I will look at this wine that hopefully the people at home listening to the podcast will have an idea of what we have in our glass from the way I describe it. But first thing you look, it is a white wine of medium amber with golden reflection. Viscosity is. That's medium plus. Very nice because they would get by viscosity, I mean the legs. And viscosity will give you either a high level of glycol, which is from alcohol, or sugar. In this case, it's more sugar. There's a bit of room variation. So we pick from the middle, from the outside, there's variation, which shows usually age or oxidation. No sediment, no gas, shows a still wine. I'm going to run with that for visual. Then I'm going to put my nose in it. Nose is clean, so it doesn't show any volatile acidity, no brettanomyces. It's not funky, anything like that. The aromas jump to the nose. So it's a high intensity. It's very generous on the nose. But the wine has is a kind of vinous character, right? And you can smell the age a little bit just from the nose. So I would describe this wine, a bit of evolution. And then when it comes to the fruit, well, you divide this in different aromatics. So you get your tropical fruit, your orchard fruit. Okay, well, here you have an orchard fruit. Is your apple freshly picked? It's a little bit like bruised. Like I grew up on apple orchard, so for me, I smell these wines. I smell like the apples that's been in the crate for a couple of days, and they're going to be great for making juice. You know what I mean?
Yep.
These are great. A bit of dried pineapple, orchard blossom, peaches, pear, like kind of the pear that you preserve in alcohol, almost like a Paul William. Then you get a florality. You can go on and just describe this wine, many ways.
This one you could describe this wine for days on the nose.
Exactly.
This is the opposite of a simple Amarino or something like that.
Exactly. And sometimes wines, by their simplicity, are great, right?
Oh yeah, of
Sometimes
course.
wines are meant to be simple, and this is great. And then you would describe the whole thing. I'm not going to do the whole grid right now for the sake of this
Yeah.
podcast. But so I would go down this whole way. And then what I need to work on specifically is making these facts into something that in the, I'm going to have an audience for the competition. And anybody in this audience, whether they're wine geeks or not, can listen to me and be like, oh, I get what he's saying.
Yeah.
If I talk about just viscosity, people will be like, what is viscosity? I'm going to make it relatable because in the end, everything that we do should be applicable to a restaurant setting and not a restaurant. I'm not going to call medium plus on the acidity for a while. People be like, what does that mean? Like, oh,
Yeah.
it's vibrant. It's laser sharp. It's, you're going to use characteristics that people can be like, okay, I see what you're saying.
And that's one of the keys to good service is translating the hardcore stuff. Oh, this is medium plus tannin, but more medium bodied. Instead of using those descriptors, it's taking those descriptors and then using the proper adjectives and verbs and stuff to the diner at whatever restaurant you're at.
100%. It's a two-way thing. So you got to do this for the guests. So put these words, well, you kind of become good eventually at gauging. You talk with the guests for 5 minutes and you figure out their level a little bit. Like, okay, they know what we're talking about, or I'll make this more approachable for them. You try to get them to put a reference. Always ask people, what do you drink at home? Oh, I drink Napa Cabernet. Perfect. This is bold. And from there, like, this is a bit more bold. This is a bit more fresher. Then you can use their baseline to kind of introduce what you want to introduce to them. The other way around as well is when they talk. Sometimes what they say is not what they mean, but you can interpret that. And I'm gonna have a lot of somebody at home that go like, yes, I know what he's talking about. Like, oh, I want a dry red. I don't like sweet wine. Okay, well, they don't want sweet, they don't want fruit. They want something more mineral driven. They don't want a dry red. They want something a little more tannic, more structured. Like, so you gotta interpret that without correcting them and making feel bad about what they're saying.
Right. And that's, yeah, such a, well, I mean, if you're doing it long enough, you know how to do that. By the way, everyone always says, I want a dry red.
Yeah.
Have you ever, in your entire history of service, people say, yeah, you know what? I like a red wine, but really sweet.
That's why you said that, because if the bottle we open right now, it was corked, have a sweet wine in my, or sweet red in my bag. So
Really?
yeah, I brought some like a late harvest Mavrodaphne from Greece. That was a bit phenomenal as well. But so I actually like reds with a touch of sugar. You'll get a perfectly good Amarone, for instance. Like,
Yeah.
that's sugar. Great examples of Zinfandel will have a couple grams of sugar as well. Like, it's all about balance, right? And they shouldn't come across as sweet, but definitely richer. And there's a place for those wines.
Oh, 100%. We sometimes in the wine some world we like to shit on sugar, we like to shit on big fruit, but as long as it's well made and there's acid on the back end, then have at it.
And I think it's a generational thing. I look at my parents, God love them, but the wine that I remember being drank at home was one of them was Arfon des Neiges, which is probably a white blend from Aldwyl that was sold in a 3 liter, box. And they drink Black Tower from Germany. And Black Tower from Germany had sugar in it. And for a palate that if your background is drinking beer and whiskey and you move on to wine, you want something that has a lot of intensity, right? Your palate is used to high ABV, very flavorful. So you're not going to drink a very delicate peanut. You want to drink something big, bold, that's going to give you that intensity. So naturally you gravitate towards those. But I think long enough drinking those, you're like, oh, you know what? I can't do this anymore. And your palate evolve over time. So my theory is everybody who gets into wine, especially later in life, they'll start bold, sweet, intense, and they'll graduate to lighter, fresher. And that's why people later in their journey usually graduate to very beautiful Chablis, Burgundies, very lighter style wines, because you start appreciating the nuance.
You go from Sonoma to Chambord Moussigny.
Exactly.
Eventually,
And hopefully your budget follows and then your income follows.
And by the way, there still is plenty of tons of good Sonoma Pinot.
100%.
Yeah, go find an old Costa Brown before the switch. Actually, you know what? You mentioned Napa Cab.
Yes.
For people listening that want something different, someone sits down and says, "I drink Napa Cab at home, but I'm here at Harbor 60. You got a great list. Where would you tell me to go that's not Napa Cab, but is Napa Cab adjacent?"
Are we talking premium or rare, like affordable?
Let's go. Let's do both. Let's start with affordable.
So affordable, funny enough, I had a very great tasting with Crewe Wine Merchants this week, a company owned by Charles Baker and Stratus. And we opened some older vintages of Stratus, of their red blends with Petit Verdot, Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Caffarel. And these wines, I can totally see them please a crowd of California. They might look down on it a little bit if I say Canada, because we associate Canada with ice wine and
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
larger producers, but there's high quality red wines that are bolder than we think. The value is always great, and they have bad vintages available. So that's one thing that we want to do at Harbor as well. We want to have a serious Canadian offer, which if we have people from the US coming, that you know what, never had Canadian wine. We'll be able to pull something maybe from Posadas La Rosa in British Columbia, for instance, or Stratus or some older Meritage blend from Taos, and be like, oh, okay, these wines are great. Like, I would totally drink that. And they're not going to bring them back.
Yeah.
So that would be budget.
Stratus is a great one. I'm still trying to interview. I got to interview the winemaker, just a crazy blender. It's on my list. Anyone listening, I know I've rarely ever talked about Stratus. They're Bordeaux blends, they're Semillons, they're white blends. It's incredible. They are consistently great one. Okay, that's a good one.
Yeah.
So for the someone that's like, okay, it's our anniversary. We don't mind spending a little bit more money, but we're not here for Napa Cab, then what?
Something that would be definitely interesting, first thing that comes to mind would be Ribera del Duero, for instance. If we go to like the premium Tempranillo blends, Tempranillo or Tempranillo-based blends from central Spain, maybe not the Rioja, they tend to maybe to be more rustic, but Ribera del Duero, if you go for a nice, if budget's no problem, you can look at something like Vega Sicilia, but Bodegas Protos, these run very, very expensive. But you know what, if you're going to buy, Bond or Harlan, these dens suddenly become a great bargain. I think these wines are phenomenal. They have a rich history. The winemaking is very, very well established. The culture is there, and the wines are, I think, phenomenal. And they do kind of scratch the itch for those larger, bigger style of wine. Nice ripeness, often American oak as well. So a lot of people who like California Napa will find themselves at home with Spanish Tempranillos.
That's a good answer.
Among, there's many other options, but that's the first one that came to
Yeah,
mind.
I know Ribera del Duero, that's a great answer there. Because it is. It's big, it's full bodied, it's bold, and yeah, it's gonna satisfy the Napa Cab
Absolutely.
drinker. So where are you on the master somm side of things? Where are you in terms of your studying or on the education side?
So I'll be honest, right now I'm in purgatory. For those who don't know, the Master Sommelier has four levels, the last one being the Master Sommelier examination, which comes in three phases where you get to do theory, tasting, and service, but you got to pass theory first in the North American chapter. I've been trying at the theory for 3 times now. It's not an easy exam. And every time you don't pass it for 3 times, you have to take a year off.
Really?
So right now I'm on my year off. And then give you that chance to like, take a year, reflect on how you're studying, how you're approaching it, and just kind of catch your breath a little bit. So that's where I am right now.
Can you give an example of how hard it is, like a question you were asked or something, like just to give the audience an idea? I mean, I know how difficult it is. I did the WSET diploma, and I know that the gap from there to the Master Somm is an incredibly large one. Just explain to people what it entails.
Absolutely. I'm not going to say a question that was on the exam. I think that's frowned upon by
Right, of course.
but I'll give
Yes.
an example of a question that could be on the exam, for
Right.
instance. One of them would be, what is the main difference in terroir between the top of the hill of Chablis Grand Cru and when it becomes Petit Chablis? What makes that difference? Why is there a line there that decides on the left is Grand Cru, on the right is Petit Chablis? Mm-hmm. Will you be able to explain that?
Yeah.
The way I would explain it, if you want the answer, twofold. First one, well, the exposure, right? If you look at the hills of the Grand Cru of Chablis, it is the most drastic exposure, which gives that additional ripeness and what makes that those sharp pieces so great. Alternatively, you're going from Cuma region, so all to Portlandian. And that also makes a difference. So that would be kind of the answer to ask. The questions, in my humble experience, and a lot of people might disagree with me, I find the questions are not that hard. It's just so broad. And it's the format is hard as well, because it's by voice, right? So you walk into a room, you have a panel of judges, 100-something questions in 1 hour, and go.
How many questions in an hour?
100-something. It can depends between 105 to 110.
Hold on. So you will be asked 100 questions or so in 1 hour in a panel of judges, and you got to start just rat-a-tat-tat giving the answers.
Absolutely.
Christ, I didn't even realize that.
But there's a purpose for that. It's supposed to mimic tableside service, right?
So, of course.
And the questions, like that's a big, like that's the big quest is how do you study for that exam? Because there's no, I mean, there's kind of a syllabus, but it's very broad. And everybody who studied for that exam goes at some point, how must, you can't learn everything. It's ridiculous. So you got to ask yourself and kind of develop, can I put this, a sense of relevance for the table. Essentially, most of the question asked you, or most of the question that should be asked to you, should eventually explain why does the wine taste the way it does. And going back to that Grand Cru Chablis question, well, if you grow Chardonnay on that hillside on Cuma Region, or you grow it in the plains on Portlandian, the grape will not grow the same way. It's not going to taste the same way. They're going to pick up at the same time. And that will influence drastically what's in the bottle. And that's why it's relevant. So the question might sound esoteric sometimes, but if you think it back, how does that correlate to the taste of the wine? And that's what matters.
Going back to the competition, tell people why they should come and check it out.
Well, you don't get to see those often. You see those in Europe and a little bit more. The U.S. now just joined the ASI, which is very exciting. For those who don't know, the U.S. didn't participate in the Assembly of the World for the longest time, as far as I know. They joined, I want to say, 2 or 3 years ago. I might be wrong on this. So now the U.S. will put on more of those local competition states and towns, and then, of course, for the best of me of the country, which now I believe Mark Guillandeau, which is based in New York, who's at Elder Madison, is going to represent the U.S. at the next Worlds. Good luck to you, Mark. But yeah, it's very fun to see those shows, right? It's like the, I don't know if you ever like watch TSN at 2 a.m. and it's a strongman competition, right?
Of course.
So it's kind of the same. I see it the same way, right? Why are they pulling a truck? Yeah. Why is this guy double decanting 6 liters of wine for a table of 8 who's not even going to drink the wine? So it's a bit of a show.
Yeah.
Like obviously we're not serving a real table, but we're doing things. We're not going to do anything boring. It's going to be a show, right? It's going to be entertaining. And sometimes you're going to be wondering, why are you doing this? But it's to show off a little bit. It's fun.
I love it. Like Magnus von Magnussen grabbing the keg and throwing it over a wooden, throwing over a wall.
Exactly.
Things like that. Yeah.
Like for instance, last year at Bosque, we had one of the panel, we just come in and there was 4 glass of bubble in front of you. And they tell you, can you classify them by, what was it? I think by their production method. Like, cool. This one is traditional. This one is Manel method. This one is Pecnat. And it was very fun. But when do you do that? Never.
No.
But it's fun, right?
Yeah.
And you can study for that. I'm not going to start drinking bubbles. I mean, I don't drink bubbles anyways, but I'm not going to start drinking bubbles with the whole purpose of like, oh, maybe they're going to ask me, how do you taste the style? You're just going to have an exposure of everything and hope for the best.
Do you have, and maybe it's competition or maybe it's just with friends, do you have a shining moment in blind tasting? And do you have a shame moment where you're like, did I really call that Bordeaux Amarone? And the other side is, I got the Assyrtiko right and no one else did. And if you can't think of any off the top of your head, that's fine. I always love asking Psalms, people that are going to these competitions, do they have a moment of pure pride and a moment of pure shame?
Well, I would say one of my latest, I guess there was 2 of them that comes to mind. I'm going to go with one of them. It's not in the competition, but I do attend friends dinner where we all bring the wines blind. It's fun to blind wine, especially in a crew that will bring sometimes wines that are very unorthodox or uncommon, and you blind it and be like, oh, for me that tastes like Bordeaux, and it's actually Chinese from Ninxia, you know. So it's very
that's just mean. Someone brings a wine from China, you can't be expecting.
No, but I think there's a purpose for that. Like blind tasting wines that you think you shouldn't be blind tasting will tell you, well, look, if I have this wine in my cellar, how am I going to treat it? Oh, remind me, tasted for me like a big Bordeaux that I will treat it as such. And something can be something as obscure as a Tanat from Uruguay.
Right.
And until you try one blind with no preconception, like, oh, that kind of tastes like Syrah for me sometimes, or it'll taste like a nice Malbec, then perfect. If somebody ever gives you a bottle without opening it, you'll be like, oh, I remember this wine kind of feels like that for me. So it's good to blind taste everything if possible. But yeah, so we're having this big dinner, and you kind of wrap your bottle in I don't know, foil, and you put it in order, like, well, I got a, let's say a 5 out of 10 big red, I'll put in the middle. And they just pop the bottles and pour it, and everybody calls, yeah, I think it's white Pinot Noir from Switzerland. Like, you call like the wackiest thing, and sometimes you get it right. And then I claimed to fame a couple of years ago, and it might have been a fluke a little bit for sure, but I just had that muscle memory. Somebody poured this red, which was obviously a Pinot Noir, but it has something vibrant and kind of juvenile to the wine. And I'm like, that tastes like a Coteau Champenois, which those who don't know, it's an unsparkling champagne. Which is a real thing, by the way. It's an appellation of France. And I'm like, that tastes like, you know, like Ambonnet, Pinot Noir, Côte de Champenois, probably very young vintage. It turns out it was. And it was like, how do you, like, taste a non-sparkling? Like, where do you get those? And it just, I had a few in my life. I know it's no expert, but just something you have a gut, and you're like, that's what I feel it is. And everybody thought I was a witch for a second. It was a bit of a fluke, I'll admit. But that was, like, it's a good feeling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a great feeling.
When you call it, and then you see the person at the other table on their face drop and be like, yeah. Did you see the bottle? Did you see the cork? Yeah.
That's the ultimate compliment if someone accuses you of cheating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then shame.
Shame. Oh, my God. This list is long. And especially when I practice for the MS and the competition, and I do those flights of wines with, I'm practicing with other MS candidates, for instance. And sometimes you make a call and you leave that tasting thinking, why am I doing this? Am I in the wrong lane? Why did I call Sauvignon Blanc on this Viognier? I'm exaggerating, but I can't pick one specifically. There's so many of them. I'm not saying that I have more shame than fame, for sure. Some days you just don't have it.
Listen, wine is humbling. Wine is, you know, you're never going to learn it all. And the moment you think you are, then there's a new rule, a new law, and Italy's just come out with a grape that no one's ever heard of before. And now you got to try to figure that out.
But I would say on the silver lining, on getting something super wrong sometimes, I sometimes call Grand Cru Burgundy on the Village. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking away thinking, oh, yeah, man, can differentiate between Grand Cru and Village? I'm like, but that Village was really good.
Yeah.
And I'm tasting this. I'm like, oh, my God, this is amazing wine. And it's a, you know, $65 New Saint George. I'm like, well, I would buy $65 for that, because for me, I was ready to pay $200 for it.
Yeah.
So then you walk away thinking, okay, well, I remember that one. I remember that producer.
Then I would go and just grab as many bottles of it as I can.
Oh, very funny. Actually, I have a story that involves Bruce Wallner. That's the sommelier.
Yeah.
We're doing, back at Sun Factory back in the days, he invites me one day. He says, oh, we're doing the Syrah masterclass. And he loves Syrah. I love Syrah as well. So his assistant back then takes the wines. Then he says, okay, there's a Côte Rôti. There's a Saint Joseph. There's a, like, a Vin de France. Like $17 wine, and there's I think like a Shiraz. We do it blind, and then we all try to call, okay, I think that's the Côte Rôti. That's me and Bruce smell the first wine, and we're like, oh, if that's not Côte Rôti, I don't know what I'm doing. And we're both called right the $17 wine, the best one in the lineup.
Really?
It was L'Appel de Sirene from François Villard, and to this day, I think it's one of the best buy you can find at LCBO for Syrah. It has like a mermaid on the label. François Villard is a phenomenal producer from Northern Rome. But that wine is, yeah, 17, 18, maybe it's $20 now with time. But this wine is phenomenal, day in, day out. And when I used to work at Restaurant Pompette, I think that was probably the first LCBO wine that I went in and I'm like, we didn't buy this. Because usually, like, those wines seem like, well, let's try not to buy from the LCBO store because we want to buy import. I'm like, that's too good. We got to buy some of this. And it was phenomenal.
Tell the audience again the name of that wine, because in case they missed it the first time, so they don't have to rewind 30 seconds, that $20 Syrah that you thought was Côte Rôti.
Oh, yeah. So the producer is called François Villard, V-I-L-A-R-D. The cuvée is called Appel des Sirènes, which is a play on word because there's a river there called the Sirène. And Sirène sounds like sirène, which is French for mermaid. Syrah, I think it's an appellation of, is it a Vin de France or is it Ardèche? It's a declassified. It's not any villages from Northern Rome. And when it's released, you'll find it in most sense. You know, it's something that I would have probably not picked up if I didn't try it before. And very happy to keep always a couple of balls at home.
Yeah, that's a good shameful moment there.
Exactly.
Not getting the, and by the way, it's such a stereotype. Every psalm, there are three wines, non-clean sparkling. There are three wines that every psalm loves.
That's not a reason.
There's Northern Rome Syrah.
Yes.
German Riesling.
Always.
And Beaujolais.
Agreed.
Always. I've never met a Somme that says, I don't care for Beaujolais or Northern Rhone Syrah. Oh,
Syrah's overrated. Never heard that.
No. No. Yeah. And by the way, it isn't. Where do you remember the moments when you first started to fall in love with wine?
Yes, very precise. I don't remember the bottle.
Oh, love it. Okay, go.
I'm, for lack of a better term, I started studying the arts. I was a painter. Like, I was trying to do some art and live the artist life when I was like in my early 20s. As most people know, you don't make a lot of money doing that. No, so you end up bartending because it pays the bills, but also it's very fun. You get paid, you do a couple shots. I was working in pubs and little brew bars and nothing fancy in Montreal. At some point, I work at this one Irish pub called McHarold's close to University of Montreal, which a lot of people at home will be like, yes, I remember this. Very great staff over there. And it was the first time I worked with a staff that could explain the difference of the different scotches that are trying to be like, well, look, if you're in the space side, a more saltiness. And that, they talk about terroir and those like kind of difference. And when people ask for a spirit, they'd be like, well, what are we looking for? And have a conversation. I never had that before. It was, hey, you want vodka? Here's vodka. Went around, that's what we got. So that was the first time I found out that you can kind of geek out about it. And I thought it was very interesting. So I hung out with these guys, learned a little bit. And that's when I decided, you know what? I like this industry. I'll do something more. So I go do study at ETHQ, the Culinary School in Montreal. And they had a restaurant at the bottom of the school where I would work in the evening to just pay my bills. And there was a sommelier there called Eric Chevrier. When I was working there, I was just, you know, clearing tables and serving dishes, and that was a server. But I didn't care that much about wine. I thought wine, $20 at the most, maybe. And otherwise, it's just expensive juice. And he was like, no, man, you don't get it. And he made it a case to really convert me. So every time we would open something for the pairings, he'd be like, sit down. That's what it is. That's what it's from. That's what we call it. Look for those notes. It really kind of walked me through it. And I played along. I'm like, that's cool, man. I get it a little bit. But then one day, he opened a bottle of Garnacha from Navarra, a producer called Pinsendonia, Cuvée El Chaparral. I always remember when he opened that Grenache, we tasted it. And I was like, that is the first time I'm like, I would drink a whole bottle of this, no problem. And I was like, that's amazing. And it wasn't an expensive wine or anything. It's not like a niche cold producer. I think it's widely available. But that was the first time I'm like, wow, I want to drink a lot of this. And from there, I was like, okay, cool, you got me. So I started learning a little bit more. And then I saw the Somme documentary, like most people in my generation. The Somme documentary just came out. And I discovered about certification. And it's very, like, they made it very sexy in that documentary. Like, oh, that was cool, the struggle, the bro culture, which looking back is like, yeah, whatever it was. But it got very interesting. So I did my intro the first time they did it in Montreal, maybe even Canada. It was the first time I did it in Montreal. And the intro was very fun, but I was very new in wine. Did my certified, moved to France, then my advanced, and then it just like tumbled off from there.
Yeah, that's a cool.
That specific.
I love
put me on the path.
I love it. So my, as I've said a billion times in the pod, I'm not going to retell the story. Mine was an old brick orange Barolo, and yours was Spanish Grenache. By the way, thank you again for. I love Sauvignon. So.
Oh, Chenin is so good.
Yeah, it really is. Let's talk about Harbor 60, because,
oh, yeah.
Like, you know, I was going over my notes and, you know, that you are now the wine director, but you just got this this position. So how long has it been? Did you just start?
Yeah, I just started. So for those who don't know, Harbor 60, the historical steakhouse on the corner of Bay and Harbor, it is an institution. It's been around for decades. Closed in April for renovation, and then we've been renovating and just really rebuilding the whole inside. Like, first of all, from the outside, historical building, you can't touch it, it's phenomenal, it's gorgeous. Inside, we're rechanging the whole thing. A lot of investment, a lot of research, a lot of brain power going to design this thing right. But also, at the same time, they want to change a little bit the thing. It's going to be a gorgeous steakhouse. We're also going to do a town restaurant on the fourth floor, they call Ariana. So you can have different experiences. So if you don't feel like eating a tomahawk or some Kobe steak, you can still go for it. Perfectly good pastas, a beautiful Italian menu, a lot of freshness, seafood. So it's going to be something for everyone there.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't interrupt the wine program.
So yeah, so one of the things as well is management is essentially all new as well. We got our head chef worked at Hollow, worked at Per Se, worked at Auberge du Soleil, L'Auberge Premier, sorry. And they took on board Alex Powell, the most recent Canadian Master Sommelier as well. And through him, he recommended me to come and work as the full-time wine director over there. So for the wine program, what you can expect at Harbor 60, it is going to be a steakhouse experience. You will find the whole lineup of your California cab verticals of all your classic producers. We've done our research. It's going to be covered. We have a ton of them. But we also want to offer something for everybody. So you're going to find, based also on Alex and I's preference, a lot of grower champagne, a lot of Burgundies, Germany, Greece. You're going to find a bit of everything for everybody. Price range, We'll start at a price for everybody in the $70, $75, and then of course there's no limit to
we
how
know
high this wine's gonna
we know
go.
what the high end is.
Exactly. So we're gonna have everything for everybody. I'm gonna have, large formats, half bottles. If you don't want to buy a glass, we want to drink something nicer. We're gonna have a serious half bottle program as well. There's gonna be something for everybody in all walks of life and all prices. And we make sure that the pricing of our wines will be relevant and down to earth as well.
So in terms of I say on the front end, I never have a problem with markups. I am pro restaurant. I've been pro restaurant my entire life. They employ so many people. They are the fabric of cities, small towns, and everything in between. I don't mind it, but you'll go to certain restaurants and I'm like, I know that's a 35, say a $35 bottle and you're selling it for 140. Or like, okay, that's a $300 bottle. And you got it for over a grand. And I'm wondering just how you approach markups, which can be an uncomfortable question because it is about money, but it's about profit, and you need profit because food's expensive, labor's expensive, real estate's expensive. So I'm wondering how you approach that.
It's a very good question, and I don't think there's any shame discussing it because more now than ever, I see more and more non-restaurant people buy from agents. Like, people know the price of things. They're not fools. They got Vivino as well. They got all these resources to find out the real value of it. So if they really want to know, they'll find it. And I think people don't mind knowing how much it costs originally. They just need to feel the value of the last on the final price, right? We're gonna have a lot of collectors that drinks crazier wines that we'll have on our list. And then they will look at our list quickly and they'll be like, okay, I know how much these wines are worth or should be worth, and part of markup's reasonable. You can't insult people's intelligence by charging, 400% on a $1,000 bottle of wine. That's not ridiculous. I'm sure I would love to make that kind of money for my business, but I gotta also owe it to my employers because they got a business to run. So I gotta find the fine line of offering the best value, but also keeping the lights on because beverages are a big part of the margin that everybody needs.
Oh yeah, 100%. So yeah, it never bothers me, but there are times. I remember once, this was years ago. This was well over 16, 18 years ago. And I was at Harbor 60, one of their just entry-level Merlots. I know what they paid for it. I know the licensing for the price, and they charged over six times that. I was just, this was a long time ago, way different management, but that one kind of, it turned me off a little bit, even though I'm there to spend money. I'm there to support. But there was that moment, I'm like, I can't do it. Like, that was just too much for me.
And it then breaks the trust beyond the wine. Now you start wondering, well, what am I getting in the food, right? That $250 steak that you got from that Australian Wagyu, well, was it really worth what you're selling me? Or am I getting, if they're doing this on this entry level, even if it's an $80 bottle of wine that it's $10 at the LCBO, you're like, time eight on that? That's very, So it's about building trust. People looking at a wine list and be like, yeah, these guys are here to give this wine approachable. But of course, nobody expects to be given those wines also. Everybody, just to hit just the right balance, and that's where you got to do your work. You got to see, okay, well, how much are these wines sold in the city? How much is the perceived value of the wine as well? Like, there's a lot of factors going
I
into
like
it.
the word trust. I think that's the perfect way to put it. If you trust, then you don't mind spending the money because you feel you're in an honest relationship with the restaurant. Now, what about buy the glass program? I've been a, this is more older traditional steak joints that the wine list is incredible. The buy the glass program feels more like an afterthought.
I think it often is, unfortunately. It is tricky to source, sorry, it is tricky to put as much passion in your buying glass that you do in your bottle list because, let's be honest, you work at a different price range. Normally, I'm generalizing, but it's tricky. A way to go around this is a lot of restaurants will have their core and pour this, and that's where they'll get more limited amount of bottles, nicer stuff that you can pour on the side for those enthusiasts. Reality is also a lot of clients, they just want a Sauvignon Blanc. They don't care which the producer is, right? I like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, which is awesome. Perfect. Doesn't matter if it's Cloudy Bay or King Crawford or Pyramid Duck, as far as I'm concerned. They just want the style and at a price that they're familiar with. The way we're gonna do it, for sure, sourcing is a big thing for us. It's a big restaurant, it's a big operation. It's not about buying three or four cases of something buying us. It's about sourcing a product that's gonna be readily available pretty much year round, almost. So that's our first challenge, but also we want something that tastes good. So we, of course, not gonna buy it blind. The way we do it is we kind of have an idea of like, okay, we want an Ono Chardonnay, we want an Oaky Chardonnay, we want a Sauvignon Blanc. Well, we're gonna ask a lot of our trusted importers, hey, do you have a Sauvignon Blanc at those prices? We'll grab a bottle, taste them side by side, probably blind, as a matter of fact, with Alex and Jacques and everybody on the team, and just be like, yeah, this is probably the best. And we'll let the wine
speak for itself. And I should say, to be fair, that as a wine geek, I love every restaurant having 15 different reds, 15 different whites, and sparkling and some rosé. But I guess a lot of the clientele at your more traditional high-end steak joints, more of that clientele is there more for maybe a cocktail and then a bottle of wine. They're not there to try some sort of funky white from Portugal they never heard of.
100%. We're not going to go very esoteric for the butter glass.
Yeah.
I guess that's not the plan. The way we want to do it instead is something that I used to do a lot when I used to work in the States is we have a more concise, we plan on having a more concise butter glass offer, but then offer a very good half bottle program as well. So because a half bottle is 2.5 glasses, right? So let's say we have a $35 Chardonnay butter glass, which is maybe not your cup of tea. Maybe it's not a producer or region you're excited about. But we have this other Chardonnay in half bottle for $80, $85. It's a half bottle. I'm like, well, you get your two glasses for a little bit more. It's from the bottle. It's fresh. It's not a bottle that's been open for 2 days waiting for you to drink it. And that's a way to offer more options at hopefully not too much of a higher spend. But also, if you're driving, you don't want to consume as much hot bottles, so it's great. I think it's an underrepresented segment of the wine service in style.
I would agree. Yeah, the half bottle thing is, you don't see it that much. I guess the thing is also, you got to get people used to it. They're probably not used to it, so they got to just make that more normal.
I agree.
Before we end, we got to talk about Pelican Wines.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I want to hear about, let the audience know. First, if they want to tell people about your consignment company.
Exactly. So Pelican Wine is a little side project that I started with two of my associates, Jonathan Bauer-Monoret, Maxime Hurt, and Jérôme Sacoun. They all currently work, Jonathan and Maxime co-own a restaurant called Vinoteca Pompette and Bar Pompette, which is currently the number one bar in Canada. And Bakery Pompette as well on College Street. So phenomenal locations. I recommend you go check it out if you haven't.
Oh, yeah.
And Jerome is currently somebody at Vinoteca Pompette. So they're my associates. They're two Alsatian, one from Brittany, very French. So and these guys, how it came about is I used to manage an agency in Quebec. So I did I had some experience with the ACQ and dealing with paperwork and things like that. But these French associates, they had these winemakers. They knew the people, but they just couldn't wrap their head around, how do we deal with the SEO? It seems so complicated, which... It will agree. It is challenging.
Yes,
so
it is.
We work together in building this very boutique agency. We don't bring in a lot of wines. We sell to a handful of restaurants in the city, a couple of collectors, and we're just having fun, really. It's a great, very carefully, how you call it?
Curated
portfolio. All French. Everybody is biodynamic, work brilliant wine, but we don't bring in, like, for lack of a better term, natty wines, anything like too esoteric.
Yeah, this wine is really funky. It smells like shit. We do nothing with it. Okay, well, we never use sulfur. Well, DRC uses sulfur. You can use a little sulfur.
Exactly.
So it's not all out there, but yeah, everything's either organic or biodynamic.
Well, we just want to work with people that pay attention to what they're doing, right? They don't just do a blanket statement like, oh, let's just fungicide this vineyard and call it a day, right?
Yeah.
We want people who spend time in the vine, spend time listening to the barrels and make a wine that they're actually proud of. So yeah, so bringing people from Rhone Valley, Burgundy, a lot of Alsace and Loire Valley. We have a champagne producer. We're a bit all over the place. If you guys want to check it out, it's Pelican Wine with an S.ca, Pelican Wines. Just send us an email if you want to try some stuff. And there's a lot of the wines available at Vinoteca Pompette as well. If you want to like, try some wines, pop it in. They usually have somebody.
See, that is awesome because like I buy so much wine from consignment companies. And if I can try it by the glass first, just get an idea, even if I trust the consignment company, trust the producer and the vintage, it's always nice to be able to have a sip before you buy a 6 or 12 pack.
Absolutely, I agree. And a lot of these producers, one of us in the company has a personal relationship with them. They're all either old friends or Jerome has worked harvest at many of them. And like it's with a lot of stories and we know them and it's always fun. And we try to go visit them when we can. And it's smaller, so we try to keep it, close,
What's the website one more time for people?
I'm sorry. Pelican like the bird. WINES, Pelican Wines.ca.
Christian, this has been great. I really enjoyed chatting with you. Thank you again. I'm loving this wine. I mean, the thing about this wine, this is a wine that every sip you smile. You cannot smile when you take a sip of this 22-year-old Sauvignon. I wish you nothing but the best of success with Bosque. I hope it goes well. I'm hoping to be there to watch it because, again, I'm a geek when it comes to all wine competitions. Yeah, what an exciting adventure for you, taking over just an iconic restaurant in Harbor 60. So I wish you nothing but the best and appreciate you taking the time today.
Thanks so much. I just want to say before we go, Bosque is on the 28th of January, 2025. Tickets will be available, I believe, very soon. You can check out the website of the Association of Sommeliers of Ontario. And yeah, it's open to everybody. You don't have to be a professional to come check it out. I recommend everybody who's curious, come check it out. It's fun. There's going to be wine, I think. And it's a fun event.
It is.
Come check it out. You don't need to wear a suit. Come as you are. You know, it's fun.
Yeah, jeans and a t-shirt. If you love wine, you'll love the event.
Absolutely. And it's going to be a big show. The four competitors this year, very high caliber. We have the sommelier from Enigma, which is a Michelin star in Yorkville. We have Christoph Rice from Dundas.
I forget.
Well, he was on your podcast earlier. I listened to his podcast. Yeah. Christoph is a great French Canadian, as much as I am.
Yes.
Matt Landry from Pro-Morissette. Phenomenal guy who's also an MS candidate. With Christoph as well, also an MS candidate. And then yours truly. So it's going to be a very high college. It's going to be fun.
Thanks again.
Royce, thank you.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.